You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 20th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Jay is out of the country, actually, on business, so he'll be away this week. And we do have an interview coming up later in the show. It's more of a conversation with Craig Good, who is in the film industry. It's a follow-up to our film discussion from last week. But what's interesting is as we're recording the show, or we were getting ready to record the show, a potentially huge science news item hit. And I know you guys have all heard about it. Bob? Mm-hmm. Do the honors. What's going on here?
Scientists or astronomers may have discovered a planet, a big planet, the ninth planet in our solar system in the Kuiper Belt, 10 times the mass of the Earth. It just blows my socks off. I hope it's true.
Yep.
They haven't seen it, but the inference of its existence seems fairly solid. And I just can't wait till it's incontrovertible evidence and we could just say, yep, we're back to nine planets, baby.
Okay. Now that we have the indirect evidence that it's there, how long before we do find that direct evidence? Are we talking months? Are we talking years?
Could be years.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Disappointing.
I'd be surprised if it were years.
Here's the stats as they're being presented so far. These are Caltech researchers. By, I guess, analyzing the gravitational influence and using computer models, et cetera, they said, yeah, there should be a planet 10 times the mass of the Earth in a very weird elliptical orbit, on average 20 times farther from the sun than Neptune. So again, it puts it in the Kuiper Belt. And now, we need visual confirmation, but if they see visual confirmation takes time, mm-hmm. especially since its orbit takes, what did they say, thousands of years to make one orbit around the sun?
I think I remember 20,000, or is it 2,000?
Between 10 and 20,000 years to make one full orbit.
Yeah. So aren't we going to have to observe it for a while to calculate its orbit and, you know, see it on multiple different places of its orbit?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. You need to see a chunk of it, a chunk of its movement before you can.
Yeah. So before we say, all right, there it is. There's the dot that probably is this world and we mm-hmm. need to confirm its orbit. That's going to take a year or two of observation, isn't it?
Yeah. Orbital confirmation for sure. But I'm talking about mainly just like, yes, there is that object. There's something out there. I don't know what its orbit is, but there's something out there with 10 times the mass of the Earth. And it's likely it's another planet.
I think those two things are connected, Bob. I think seeing it is going to involve seeing it move against the background stars and calculating its orbit and saying, yes, it's in the orbit that we predict this thing should be in. That's how we're going to know. That's how we're going to confirm it.
We can't just sick all our computers and point a few telescopes we've got up there already at it and say, you know, let's go get it right now.
No, the whole point is, though, Evan,
I don't know why
we have to see it moving. That's how we know it's a planet, is that we see it moving in a certain orbit.
As opposed to what, though? What else would it be?
An asteroid, a comet.
Yeah, it could be like
whatever.
Pluto. It could be a planetoid. It could be – there's a lot of – options.
Yeah,
but
guys, it's difficult.
We're not discussing the irony here. The irony that Mike Brown, Pluto killer, is one of the two researchers that discovered this potentially new planet.
Wow. Talk about shooting the messenger in 2006. I mean, that was really, that's
hey,
exactly what happened there.
He adopted the moniker. He wrote a book called How I Killed Pluto.
Yes.
He owns it. Yeah.
He absolutely
good for him. I mean, you know, what the hell. Yeah.
But I love that he is one of the two researchers that's like, hey, we think we found
that
a new
awesome.
One.
That is awesome. That's fantastic that he's actually in there. But Steve, one thing I wanted to do, it took me a little digging to find out precisely, the article I read was talking about it and it took a while, but they finally said exactly what this evidence really is. So basically, if you look at some of the bigger objects in the Kuiper Belt that we already know about, and if you look at their orbits and their movements, it just didn't make a lot of sense. If you drew a line through them, they kind of converged onto a point which made a lot of sense in terms of its explaining their anomalous movement. And so it's based on this movement that they said there's got to be something with this mass in this area.
Influence.
So it was very interesting. And the inference is, it's fascinating and it seems solid, but I can't wait till we can really, say without hesitation, yes, the solar system now has five bona fide planets. And then the question nine, is, yeah. you know, yeah, nine. What did I say?
Five.
Five.
I did not.
You probably meant five giants is what.
Oh, you, wow. I don't know what the hell I was saying. So, the thing is, we were talking about before the show now. Now, 10 times the mass of Earth, we kind of calculated, that it would probably be, potentially somewhat near the mass of Uranus. Was that it or was it Neptune?
Uranus is 14 Earth masses. This would be 10. So it's almost as big as Uranus. So that puts it right at just about into gas giant territory. Probably bigger than a super Earth, right?
Or, yes.
And is between a super Earth and a gas giant right in there.
Yeah, I think it seems fairly certain that it probably will be, you know, most likely a kind of a tiny gas giant, which is, wow, which is really cool.
No chance it's a solid rocky world. It's definitely gaseous.
I think there's a chance.
I wouldn't say no chance.
Again, it's right in that transition zone between rocky super Earths and small gas giants.
Because how cool would that be? The largest rocky planet orbiting the sun so far away. Just tremendous.
Now, my question is, in terms of back to actually seeing it and identifying it, the Kuiper Belt is far away. I mean, this mm-hmm. is really far away. I wonder if it's even possible to get an image, a solid, even if it's just a few pixels. Remember, we could only see Pluto on Earth-based telescopes. It was just like a few pixels, you know, 10, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we needed
so
the flyby.
This is much farther away. So we may never really, not for, you know, potentially many, many decades until we could maybe get a probe sort of near there.
Oh,
will
boy.
We ever see anything, you know, to really nail down what this thing looks like? So that's kind of disappointing.
This is much farther away than Pluto?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, 20 times further than Neptune.
But Pluto's in the Kuiper's belt.
Yeah, no. Barely.
So, remember, is it?
It's a Kuiper's belt object.
Remember, but Pluto crosses the orbit of Neptune.
Right.
I think Pluto was closer than Neptune up until like the 1990s.
Yeah, it was. It was probably a little closer when we were finally able to get to not closer than it has been in the past, but closer when we were able to image it than its orbit will take it.
Imagine if Horizon, the probe, just happened to be heading towards this new planet.
I know. I'm like, it's in the Kuiper's belt. It's over there by Pluto. Like, why can't it just swing by?
Just turn to the right. Yeah. To the right. Go right.
Yeah.
Starboard.
Side
starboard
of the solar system.
It could be. Yeah, it could be the opposite side of the solar system. So this is breaking news. You know, this is just the details that are available at this point in time. This has to be peer reviewed. This, you know, the astronomical community is going to pore over this. Who knows? This could go the way of superluminal neutrinos, or the first
planet Vulcan,
the first report of gravity waves, which was a bust. You know, just these kind of things evaporate when those darn skeptical scientists try to look at the data critically and figure out, is it really, really true? But it seems like, it's reasonable that this could be true. We just need confirmation. And this is something that we've talked about. We've been hoping for that we find a new cool planet out there in the Kuiper Belt. And here you go.
And I doubt it. Something like this is going to happen again for a really long time. You never know. But
yeah,
this is rare. This is like a cool, rare thing.
It's beyond rare. Think about it.
It's been 150 years.
Yeah, we've discovered That's only rare. Two new planets like in modern times. So this is the
You mean in our
huge.
Solar system.
In our
we've
solar
system. Yes. A lot of planets.
Yes, in our
Not
solar
exoplanets.
System.
Not exoplanets. Yeah. Yeah, this would be only the third planet discovered in our solar system, I mean, not visible with the naked eye and known in ancient times.
That's awesome.
Interesting.
Because Pluto doesn't count anymore. It's a dwarf planet.
So it was four. This would
It was three, then it went down to two.
Take it back to three.
Take it back to three. In fact, it was Ceres was briefly considered to be a planet, then was demoted to an asteroid, then promoted to a dwarf planet. Pluto was a planet and demoted as kind of a judgment call, but whatever. Demoted to a dwarf planet.
I know what I was gonna say. I love that planets are a promotion and asteroids are a demotion.
Bob, tell us about the forgotten superhero of science.
For this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science, I'm going to talk about Stephanie Louise Kwolek, 1923 to 2014. She was an American chemist who invented an amazing material known throughout the world, for much of the world, as Kevlar. So while Kwolek was at DuPont, she and her team were trying to create a lightweight fiber replacement for the steel in radial tires. She was working with a carbon-based molecules, trying to join them into bigger molecules to make polymers. She was trying to convert a solid polymer into a liquid so it could then be spun into fibers. But the liquid that she ended up with this batch, looked kind of crappy. Instead of being clear and thick, like a syrup, which is what you would expect from to turn a polymer into a really good fiber, it was thin and it was opaque, and everyone told her, just throw it out, you're not going to get a decent fiber out of that. But she persisted. She persuaded another researcher to run the liquid through a laboratory spinneret to separate the liquid from the fibers. And I love that they call it a spinneret, because spiders mm-hmm. have spinnerets that mm-hmm. make their webs, yep. which is so cool. So when the fibers were spun, the polyamide liquid crystal molecules all lined up to create fibers with an amazing stiffness. And the rest is history, as they say. Today, Kevlar is everywhere, with a tensile strength to weight ratio 5 times stronger than steel. We all know that it kicks butt as a bulletproof vest. That's a no-brainer application. But it's also used in many different things like car tires, firefighter boots, fiber optic cables, armored limousines, and even canoes. And they also use it for bomb-resistant building materials and hurricane safe rooms, things like that, even bridges. Kwolek received many awards. My favorite award that she received, I never even heard of before, she received the National Medal of Technology, which Ooh. Is now my officially most favorite medal of all time, the Medal of Technology. And in 95, she was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Many, many more awards that she received during her career. An amazing scientist, an amazing invention. And so remember Stephanie Louise Kwolek. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing polyparaphenylene terephthalamide, you know, if it comes up.
Yeah, or when taking a bullet for your friends.
Yes. So that nasty long word is that's what Kevlar is. And Kevlar is actually it's a copyrighted term. It's a registered trademark for a para aramid synthetic fiber.
You know, Bob, if you can't pronounce it, you shouldn't wear it.
Yes.
I only wear organic Kevlar. Yeah.
That's right.
None of that synthetic Kevlar shit.
Real spinnerets and whatnot.
Right. All right. Kara, I understand that we have some new information regarding the effectiveness of wearing motorcycle helmets.
Yes, I love this story. It's kind of a duh story, but I think periodically we need to hear the science behind the duh stories. So, of course, our friend David Gorski posted a new piece on science-based medicine about mandatory helmet laws. And this comes from the fact that in April 2012, Michigan actually repealed its mandatory helmet laws. At the time, the researchers who wrote this new study for the American Journal of Surgery, Carlos Rodriguez, he's kind of the principal investigator on this, said, quote, "I just could not help but notice the number of patients that had been in motorcycle crashes with no helmet on, which was enormously different in number and volume than we had experienced the weekend before." So he's talking about the immediate before and aftermath. But of course, Dr. Rodriguez is a scientist. He's a scientific thinker. And he said, "I'm not satisfied just making this observation by gut feel alone. I want data." So he and his colleagues at their trauma center decided to do a cohort study. They looked at the peak motorcycle season, which is April to November, in a certain part of Michigan for the year prior to the mandatory helmet laws being repealed, and then compared it to the 3 years following the change. And here is a little summary of what they found. First, and probably most intense, among the accident victims that actually made it to the hospital, not the ones that died on the scene, the proportion of riders who had not been wearing a helmet rose fourfold, from 7% to 28%. So just repealing the law made it so that way more people were like, I guess I don't need to wear my helmet. Another big one, among riders who died at the crash scene, the proportion not wearing helmets rose from 14% to 68%. Big difference. And then about 10% of non-helmeted riders that were brought to the hospital died there, compared to only about 3% that were wearing helmets. there's a few more kind of interesting statistics that I wanted to point out, but those are the ones that really kind of hit me over the head. So there was a higher injury severity score among non-helmeted versus helmeted riders, which makes sense. There was a lower Glasgow coma score. And of course, that score is opposite what you would think. So a low score is bad. A low score means that you're more unconscious.
You get points for being able to do stuff, right?
Yeah. And so that was a 12.6 versus a 14.0, which is actually a pretty big difference. The percentage of patients that required the ICU was 55% versus 31%. The percentage of patients requiring mechanical ventilation was 24% versus 12%. And another weird finding was that there was a higher proportion of unhelmeted riders that had alcohol in their system. So they found that the helmeted riders were either less likely to drink, or people were less likely to drink were not wearing helmet, or I'm sorry, were wearing helmets. It's hard to put causation to that, obviously, but they did see a correlation there. So, you know, the first, I guess, reaction is like, duh. That's like what I think when I read about this, right? And I think that that's what Gorski thought too when he wrote about it. But he further wanted to dig deep and talk about what this means, I think, for whether or not legislation should be in place and whether or not the anti-helmet advocates, who he actually compares to anti-vaxxers in like a really big way, have, I don't know, like a standing for their argument, which is often based on personal freedom. When we hear about anti-vaxxers saying, I should be able to not vaccinate my kid, it's really easy to say, yeah, but then you're putting my kid at risk. When somebody says, I should be able to ride without a helmet, it's harder to make that argument that you're putting me at risk. No, you're putting your own head at risk. But it is obviously more complicated than that, especially now that we are operating in a system where we have like universal health coverage. And where the money that we put into the system is actually going to, in one way or another, be affected by whether or not people make the choice not to wear a helmet. So I don't know. I think about growing up in Texas. In Texas, they have a crazy helmet law. So you have to wear a helmet unless you decide to take this special course in which they just show you a bunch of videos of dead people who didn't wear helmets. And then if you get through the course, you can go, okay, I don't want to wear a helmet anymore.
They try to scare people.
And that's not evidence-based.
Into making the right decision.
It's not evidence-based.
Because the scared straight approach doesn't work.
Yeah.
No, I can't imagine it would.
It's crazy. And so in Michigan, they are...
That's pure pseudoscience.
It's pure pseudoscience. So in Michigan, they did do a little something where basically they're saying you don't have to wear a helmet, but if you choose not to wear a helmet, you have to carry like an extra $20,000 in insurance. But based on the analysis that Gorski did, it's not enough. It's not enough to offset the risk benefit there. $20,000 in extra insurance really comes out to be more money for the insurance company and not enough money to make up for the increase in death, the increase in hospital time, the increase in surgery, all of the things that come along with having these really severe ICU necessitated injuries.
So it sounds like the anti-helmet proponents are basing their stance on the fact that they don't want government, in a general sense, telling them what to do.
They don't want the nanny state protecting them from themselves.
Yes, and they
also... You know, they want to go and ride without a helmet. That's it. It's up to me. Yeah, I may crack my head open, but it was my choice.
At least they're making the appropriate... I'm not going to say correct, but appropriate argument, you know?
Yeah,
but
at
sometimes,
first blush.
Yeah, but sometimes they say that... Well, the helmet laws, forcing people to wear a helmet, when people wear a helmet, they drive more recklessly and it's actually endangering. It's like an unintended consequence of a false sense of security. So people drive recklessly, but that's actually not true. It's not what the data shows. So that's the pseudoscientific argument.
Well, and there's a couple more pseudoscientific arguments. There's some that argue that, the data is fixed, that the data is influenced by big industry, and there's actually no evidence to support the fact that helmets improve your recovery or that helmets prevent death. And then there's
just
some,
crazy time now.
Which is just crazy time, but this is actually a common kind of lobby perspective. And then there's some other ones that actually cite one study that was a kind of a discredited study that wearing a helmet could actually increase your risk for a cervical spine injury. Mm-hmm. So like you would hurt your neck if you were wearing a helmet. And so all these people are like using that. You know how that kind of sometimes happens where it's like, we'll mm-hmm. cherry pick one thing out there and that'll become our rallying cry. Yeah. That's another really pseudoscientific approach that the anti-helmet lobby is taking. And that's the thing. This is something that there is a truthiness to it, right? There's a gut reaction to it. Gorski talks about working in trauma and it almost being a joke that like obviously these motorcycle injuries are just some of the most brutal things that they see in there, that riding motorcycles is incredibly dangerous. And if you don't ride with a helmet, it's like a recipe for disaster. But seeing the numbers, it's intense.
As a public health measure, it's a no-brainer.
A no-brainer. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
No pun intended there.
Oh. I hope not.
Oh, yeah. Evan got that before any of us did.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He always does. Things, you know. Yeah. I'm always on the hunt.
Yeah. So at least we have to, the science is the science. You know, we could make the political, ethical judgment calls, you know, value judgments about freedom versus protection versus whatever. But at least we should do it with the proper evidence. And I always get annoyed when people have an ideological point, and so then they just make up the science to back up their ideology rather than admitting the science and sticking to a value or ethical argument. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you say, okay, yeah, I understand that it's safer to wear helmets. I still don't want to wear them. I just don't think the state has a right to tell me to protect me from myself. I just don't believe in the quote-unquote nanny state. That's fine. That's at least an internally consistent argument. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to argue that, oh, the helmets are not protecting, that's just wrong. It's just not backed by the science. Then you're just making a pseudoscientific argument. Well, guys, did you see or hear about Charlie Sheen on the Dr. Oz show?
Where he revealed that he was HIV positive, at least officially.
And that he's not taking medication?
Because of some Mexican doctor?
So Charlie Sheen announced not too long ago that he is HIV positive. When he was diagnosed, his viral load, that's basically a measure of how many viruses are circulating in your fluids, in your blood, was 4.4 million. After 6 months of standard HIV, anti-HIV cocktail, his viral loads were undetectable, which is, that's standard, right? That's what we want, which we expect. You take the full cocktail of medications, and it drops your viral load down to very low levels, and you know, with the goal being undetectable. That has two advantages. It actually does prevent progression to AIDS. It prevents, you know, any of this, the complications of being chronically infected with HIV, to the point where you have pretty much a normal life expectancy on those drugs. I mean, that's what we call a remission, right? We wouldn't call it a cure. But it's a remission in that the disease is still present, but it's not having any effect on your longevity or your quality of life. And it also reduces the risk of transferring HIV through sex or other contact because, you know, the virus isn't circulating. So it's actually also a good public health measure to keep those viral loads undetectable. Sure. So you would think, you know, with successful treatment, You would be happy with that, but
yeah. But Steve, taking a pill every day—it's just like such an onerous task.
Yeah, it's actually multiple pills, multiple times a day. I mean, I will say that. Yeah, in fact, the rigor of the anti-HIV cocktail is a problem in third world countries. You know, where it's hard, you know, to take timed medications throughout the day. But in any case.
We're even getting them,
I assume. A small price to pay, right? Taking medications every day is a small price to pay to curing a horrible, otherwise terminal disease. But Charlie Sheen wasn't content, apparently, with that. He decided that he was going to go off of his medications, which had, you know, brought his viral loads under control, and get some quack treatment from a guru in Mexico who is claiming that he can cure HIV and cure cancer, too. You know, why not? Just throw that in there.
Sure.
Yeah. So he was recently on the Dr. Oz show, which was essentially an intervention by Dr. Oz and by Charlie Sheen's personal doctor. Mm-hmm. I think it was staged. I mean, from watching it felt like the whole thing was staged, like the outcome was never in doubt. Because after his doctor makes like this personal plea to Charlie Sheen to go back on his medications, Sheen agrees to do it. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going back on my medications, and everybody claps. Hey, isn't that wonderful?
Oh my gosh.
So the whole thing seemed, you know, like it was just an orchestrated kind of little melodrama. But It's interesting, you know, that Charlie Sheen, as we've spoke about in the past, is a bit of a like a 9/11 conspiracy theorist, and yep. you know,
well, he's also bipolar, by the way. I think
is that
well,
official?
He's, does, well, he's by winning. I think that was his response to the idea that yeah, that's when he was like, "I'm not bipolar. I'm by winning." I mean, it's I can't see his medical records, but I think that there has been a fair amount, and he has publicly said that he has got a bipolar disorder.
He's got a diagnosis. Yeah.
And it does kind of line up with his behavior.
Unfortunately, though, celebrities like him, everyone, you know, if you have a chronic, if you have a serious illness, cancer, whatever, I can't tell you how many people have told me this. If you're a patient, you get diagnosed with something like HIV or cancer, you become a magnet for charlatans and con artists. They are sharks and they prey on anyone who's desperate. You will hear about it. You'll hear about it from your friends, family members, coworkers, whatever. And there could be a lot of pressure, you know, to seek out these crazy alternative treatments. So unfortunately, celebrities, I think, probably come under more pressure because think about what a coup that would be for any practitioner to have Charlie Sheen, you know, have a celebrity.
Sure. Celebrity endorsement.
As your patient. Couple of other interesting wrinkles here. One is that this Mexican doctor told Dr. Oz that, and Charlie Sheen verified this on the show, that he injected himself with Charlie Sheen's blood to prove how confident he is that his treatment is legitimate and that it works.
Wow, he's an idiot.
Wow.
I don't think he really did that.
Think he
There's
did
no
it
way.
Either.
And also, I want to bet money. I hate to say this. I want to bet money that Charlie Sheen also has hepatitis.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah. That
like, why would you inject yourself with somebody's blood without doing a full work? Well, just, or you would reject it. You can't inject yourself with other people's blood.
It's just dumb. Yeah. It's unprofessional too. It's crazy. Yeah. It's totally inappropriate, unprofessional. It's a stunt.
Yeah.
To me, it was a stunt that said, I'm really desperate to get this celebrity in my clutches. You know, I'm going to do what it takes to convince them that I'm legitimate because then I've won the lotto right now. Then, you know, my two-bit operation will explode.
Yeah.
So that's what I think was going on there. We've talked about Dr. Oz a lot on the show before. That's the other thing. Dr. Oz did say, like, he wants to take his show more scientific this year. We were like, yeah, we'll believe it when we see it. I don't know if this is part of him trying to remake his image, like he's putting himself in the role of skeptic in this situation, although this is very low-hanging fruit, but still. Although I think that, interestingly, I think he's a novice if he's trying to be skeptical because, you know, by mentioning the name of the doctor, he is driving more business to that quack in Mexico.
Yeah.
Then his skepticism would be diverting people away from it.
Sure.
So he just handed a huge bonanza to that doctor, to that quack in Mexico. Whether he didn't care that he was doing that, or he was naive and not thinking that that would happen. But with that aside, at least he was taking the scientific position, and you know, to his audience was at least, you know, supporting the effectiveness of modern, you know, anti-HIV treatment, which is it's one of the huge medical scientific success stories. I mean, 30 years ago, it was a new disease. We had no idea. It was a almost guaranteed terminal illness. And over a short period of time, just, you know, in years, you're likely to succumb to multiple opportunistic infections and cancers, et cetera. And now it's essentially a chronic manageable illness with a normal life expectancy. I mean, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. That is the power and success of reductionist science-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times people say, well, and there's a kernel of truth to this, that alternative practitioners target illnesses that we cannot treat or cure. Sure, that's true, but that isn't necessary. They will also target diseases that we can treat, even extremely effectively. They're still targeting patients with HIV, even though we pretty much have achieved, you know, a reasonable goal of treatment of putting people essentially into a full remission for a normal life expectancy.
They want to hear that they're cured.
Right.
There's something that we culturally, like, we're so bad, I think, as a culture and even as science communicators of talking about disease as if it's an infection. Like every type of disease is like a bacterial infection where you can be populated, take a pill, and then it's gone. You're cured of it. And we talk about cancer that way. We talk about HIV that way. And it gives people unrealistic expectations of what they can achieve.
I'm going to disagree with you in that I don't think that's the fault of science communicators or the profession, because I think I don't see that happening. I don't see bad science communication creating that belief, that narrative in patients. I think it's the culture doing that.
And I'll give you that, but I don't think we do a good job of undoing it. I've seen the term cure cancer in a fair amount of scientific, like popular science articles, which bothers me.
Yeah, maybe pop, but not good ones, though.
Yeah, I agree.
Certainly, the profession, I think, is pretty good when it comes to communicating that. I spend a lot of my time, certainly, undoing that narrative that people pick up from the culture. And I think that's being driven a lot by alternative con artists. They're the ones driving this narrative of there's this one simple thing that's wrong with you, and it's outside of you, and we're going to make it go away. Yeah. And then you're going to be restored to your natural state of perfect health. You know, that something is taking you away from either a toxin or an infection or whatever.
You're out of balance.
That's their narrative. Whereas our narrative
thing.
Our, you know, the science-based narrative is, well, it's complicated. There's lots of different things that could be happening. And lots of times there are just, you know, things go wrong with the body that we can't cure, but we could manage them. We could manage them, you know, sometimes very well. Sometimes not so well, but we do the best we can with the evidence and the technology that we have. Sometimes I have to spend a lot of time convincing patients that it's okay, or that it's at least a reasonable and acceptable outcome. You know, that first one, like, we can't make a really highly specific diagnosis. We can't find the bug that's infecting them, because there isn't a bug that's infecting them. It's just a dysfunction in some, you know, something in the body, or that, you know, there may not be a cure, but we could manage it, and we could manage it fairly well, right? Like, there's lots of things. Most things we can't cure. Most things that we treat, as, you know, on the medicine side, not like the, you know, the surgery side, where that's more of like they're trying to, you know, anatomically fix a specific problem. But like, most of medicine is managing chronic illness, not curing it.
Yeah, it's because you can cure it. You don't want to, because then you can keep people on medicine all the time. Yeah,
that's part of the con artist narrative.
Right. Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
It's like, well, that, yeah, your doctors want to manage your chronic illness because they're trying to make money off of you, as opposed to that's just the limits of our science and technology. People don't want that to be the answer. They don't want the answer to be this is the limits of our current technology. So the con, I think, has evolved to be optimal in terms of dealing with human psychology, and at the same time also is affecting the public and the cultural narrative. And so, yeah, people have these unrealistic expectations because people have been catering to those unrealistic expectations. All right, a couple more quick news items. Evan, there's some recent evidence about early humans in the Arctic.
Yeah, there is. So we go back to 2012. It's a place called Yenisei Bay, which is about 2,000 kilometers south of the North Pole, where an 11-year-old Russian boy had made an incredible discovery, the remains of a woolly mammoth. And experts have said that this is one of the best preserved mammoth finds in about a century. So it was not just any woolly mammoth, though. The carbon dating revealed that this creature, or critter, as some people like to say, was alive approximately 45,000 years ago, and that it met its demise at the hands, or rather the spear tips, of humans, which is
cool.
Fascinating. The team was led by archaeologist Alexei Tikhonov, who excavated the mammoth and dubbed it Xenia for the child. That's his nickname. That's the child's nickname, so now that's the name of the mammoth. And their findings were recently published in Science Magazine Online. The paper was titled Early Human Presence in the Arctic, Evidence from 45,000-Year-Old Mammoth Remains. So from the abstract, here's how they describe it. Archaeological evidence for human dispersal through northern Eurasia before 40,000 years ago is rare. In West Siberia, the northernmost find of that age is located at 57 degrees north latitude. Elsewhere, the earliest presence of humans in the Arctic is commonly thought to be circa 35,000 to 30,000 years before present. a mammoth kill site in the central Siberian Arctic dated 45,000 years before present expands the populated area to almost 72 degrees north latitude. The advancement of mammoth hunting probably allowed people to survive and spread widely across northmost Arctic Siberia.
Yeah, they were probably following the mammoths.
Oh my gosh, look at 72. I went over to my globe. Look at 72 degrees north on your globe. And you are really near the top of the world there.
Yeah.
Fascinating that people so far, so long ago were able to survive in this, God, inhospitable climate.
I've always wondered that. Like, why did people leave Africa and go to where it's shitty and cold?
Follow the food.
Ugh, I don't know if food would motivate me enough for that.
I'd go hungry.
Me too.
But you also have to remember, it's not like one group of people migrated from Africa to the Arctic. It's, you know, there probably wasn't a lot of walking around either. It's just that you when you have to expand your village, you go over there. You know, you go over there 10 miles
slow
and you set
and
up
steady.
Your village. Yeah, so like even like maybe every generation, like they're moving a little bit down the road. And then over 1,000 years or 10,000 years, you know, the population spreads out. So people are acclimating each step of the way. Each generation is probably only moving one slight notch further north, right? They're not. Does that make sense? They're not going from like Africa to the Arctic.
I will give you that, but I don't think anybody is fully acclimated to living at 72 north latitude.
Well, they did it. They did it.
They did it.
Yeah, but they were wearing like mammoth skins and shit.
Had
Nobody
to.
Was like, ah.
What about the Inuit? I mean, the Inuit lived there. I mean, they're.
Yeah. They were inventive. That's not quite the word.
Resourceful.
Resourceful. Yeah. That's resourceful. What I'm looking for.
They live inside tauntauns.
Yeah.
This discovery is being certainly, you know, embraced by a lot of people. Other scientists are looking at the data as well, and they're reminding us that we need to be a little cautious. Sometimes scientists are suggesting that the Russian team of scientists should report the method used to rule out contamination of the bone collagen for dating. So they need to share that data.
They're going to verify the dating. But one thing that's interesting is the different types of evidence we use to know that humans were present. So obviously we could find actual human remains. Mm-hmm. We could find tools made by humans because no one else makes like stone tools. But in this
excrement.
Case, we found, yeah, you could find like humans, their DNA, their whatever, there's parts of people or their actual fossilized bones. Or you could find the effects that people had on their environment. And this is one of those types of effects where, you know, clear evidence of hunting. Stone weapons make certain marks in bones, or cracking open bones to get the marrow, or cutting the meat away from the bone, again, leave certain marks on the bone. Or sometimes, you know, we have found fire pits. We know that somebody was cooking fire there 20,000 years ago or 30,000 years ago, whatever. So that's interesting. In this case, we could tell from the mammoth itself that it was hunted by people, even though we haven't found the people there themselves.
That's cool.
Right, right. We can infer that they were there, definitely.
Invisible people.
Bob, you're gonna pop my Spider-Man balloon.
Yeah, a little prick, little tiny prick.
Bob, that's not what Mary Jane says.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, nice.
Hi-yo.
Okay.
Oh. Hi-yo.
So, yes, so we move on. So researchers studying biological adhesion conclude that geckos are the largest vertical climbers in nature because any animals much heavier would require sticky feet that are just too damn big. Now, lots of articles I came across, of course, they're going to call into play Spider-Man. Yes, Spider-Man has to be involved in this article somewhere. But my favorite article was from name anyway, was from Popular Science. The title was "The Science Behind Why Spider-Man is Too Large to Cling to Walls. With great mass comes the need for really big feet." So I thought that was kind of funny. But seriously, science is cool and all, but when it tells me I can't be a superhero, I get really pissed. So let's go over what the researchers found out before I start making my Doc Ock robot arms. So these were researchers from the University of Cambridge's Department of Zoology. And so they looked at the weight and the sticky foot pad size of 225 climbing creatures, including mites, frogs, spiders, geckos, etc. And that covers seven orders of magnitude in weight, so a huge, huge range. This is called allometry. That's the study of the relationship between body size to things like shape, physiology, behavior, etc. Interesting stuff. So they discovered a limit to climbing that's based on this biological adhesion. So the bigger you are, the more relative surface area on your body that needs to stick. So look at a mite. It's so tiny. It has a lot of surface area compared to its volume, much more surface area. Now go to the other end of the spectrum. A whale, on the other hand, is mostly all volume with just a tiny amount of surface area when you compare the two. So that's very important. Okay. So it's obvious then, you know, the heavier you get, the more sticky areas you need, or the stickier they need to be. But if you have increasingly less relative surface area available, then this research implies that there's a limit to how big you can be and still climb walls in a biologically practical way. So that's the bottom line.
So how big can you get?
It's a gecko. That's it. You're not gonna, you know, there's no animals that use this bigger than a gecko. Yeah. And,
so like not an iguana. That's why iguanas don't climb walls.
Well, yeah, they can get much heavier, can't they? Yeah. So basically when they they're huge. You'll never see that. So when creatures got a certain size, evolution euphemistically said, screw this. And it just evolved toes and claws to make these heavy climbers, because it was just like, you know, walking around with huge feet and hands would have some disadvantages. So the question then is, what would a human Spider-Man look like then? So that person would need 40% of their body to be sticky. So that means 80% of the front of your body, because why have stickiness front and back? That's not going to help you. Most of the front of your body would need to be sticky. If it was, you know, isolated to your feet, you would need really big feet, crazy feet. So some scientists calculated, that you would need a size 145, which is a US size 114 shoe. So, my foot size is 9.
It's a really big shoe.
Didn't even see that one coming. So I calculated, based on a shoe size that big, I calculated that each foot would be 3.8 feet long, or 1.14 meters. So that's some big-ass feet. So that's how big your
Holy
feet would
shit.
Have to be. So so clearly Spider-Man would look a tad ridiculous, and it really wouldn't work out. Now, I got to throw this in here. For Spider-Man purists – you know who you are. So according to the first version of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, Spider-Man's wall climbing abilities come from the mental control of the flux of interatomic attraction between molecular boundary layers. So I'm not talking about that. That's, you know, fun but silly and not scientific. I'm not talking about that. So that's not going to happen. You're not going to put on gloves and little footies that are going to allow you to use sticky pads or the van der Waals force to climb walls. That's not going to happen. So that's the big bummer in all this. But all is not lost, because as we know, technology is often inspired in wonderful ways by what's available in nature.
Or we could shrink people down really small, then they could.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, but then you've got only, you know, a hundredth of the atoms in your brain, and that, you know, has other problems.
That's true. All right, Kara. Yeah. What's the word this week?
I'm always like, what? You talking to me? yeah. Yes, this week the word is a fun one. It's agnotology. So what do you guys think of when you think
agnostic.
No, right? Agnostic, exactly. So the definition, plain and simple, agnotology is the study of willful acts to spread confusion and deceit.
What does that have to do with skepticism?
Chaos or theory. Win favor. I know. I love this word.
God.
I feel like
it sounds very political.
I feel like everybody who listens to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is going to walk away using this word in their regular vocabulary. So
how did I not know this word? It's so perfect for skepticism. It's great.
Oh yeah.
The reason you don't know it is because it's a made-up word.
Oh, fuck.
By a science historian at Stanford. I love this, you guys. So there's this great story on BBC Future by Georgina Kenyon. She's the byline on that story. And it's about this idea of agnotology. So apparently, this science historian at Stanford, Robert Proctor, invented the word when he was researching kind of some of the seedy actions of big tobacco, where these big corporations would twist the science and confuse the public about the link between cigarettes and cancer, because they were trying to say there wasn't one. And according to the article, you know, Proctor says that the word, quote, comes from agnosis, the neoclassical Greek word for ignorance or not knowing, and ontology, the branch of metaphysics which deals with the nature of being. Agnotology is the study of willful acts to spread confusion and deceit, usually to sell a product or win favor. I have a few more quotes that I've combed here from Robert Proctor. The first one is, I was exploring how powerful industries could promote ignorance to sell their wares. Ignorance is power, and agnotology is about the deliberate creation of ignorance. Here's another one. In looking into agnotology, I discovered the secret world of classified science and thought historians should be giving this more attention. And the last quote that I think is really apropos, the 1969 memo and the taxed, and I don't know if you guys know about this, but there's like a really glaring memo that the tobacco industry was hammered about in 1969. It didn't come out until later. That just is pointedly disgusting if you read it, like a lot of the text in it. It's horrible.
This is mustache twirling.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
The smoking gun. It's the smoking gun of villainy.
It's the smoking gun. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh,
and
my
so
gosh.
His quote here is, the 1969 memo and the tactics used by the tobacco industry became the perfect example of agnotology. Ignorance is not just the not yet known. It's also a political ploy, a deliberate creation by powerful agents who want you not to know. And I love this word. So this idea of spreading ignorance, and it's not just, because oftentimes in the skeptic movement, we talk about it like, oh, well, people, you know, it's a knowledge deficit. It's because people aren't aware, or they're not very scientifically literate, or they haven't read the things that they need to know. But there are forces at work. The anti-vax movement is a force at work. We talk about this. The anti-GMO lobby, it's a force at work. The cigarette industry at the time, this was, and still today, is a force at work, and they are utilizing this agnotology.
The money quote from that memo, which is iconic now, is doubt is our product. They literally said that
great.
Doubt is our product. Their job was to sow doubt and confusion about the connection between tobacco and cancer.
Yeah, it's this whole idea of teach the controversy. Right.
Yeah.
I hate that product.
It was not controversial.
And so
they outlined
so can't
their
hold
strategy
up in court either.
For mm-hmm. sowing doubt and confusion.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's all you
yeah.
need is some they, reasonable doubt in court and lawsuits and things, and you've got it.
The whole idea of cherry picking studies, finding experts that did to present the minority opinion, and then you have experts disagreeing. And once you have experts disagreeing, hey, how's the public supposed to know who's right and who's wrong? I mean, and you could see a one-to-one correlation almost, for example, with the climate denier industry.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, yeah.
The same strategies are there. It is denialism. It is what we today call denialism.
Exactly.
But agnotology, I guess, is a subset of denialism that is deliberately manufactured for some secondary gain. It's not just an outflow of an ideology or like vaccine denial, which is just crazy. It's, you know, there's a specific goal in mind.
It's the architects. The architects are the ones practicing this agnotology. And, you know, in the article, I think it does a good job of sort of informing or reminding us that this happens on both sides of the aisle. This happens, you know, it does not matter what your political persuasion is. It does not. You will see examples of agnotology across the board. I love it. I mean, I don't love it, but I love the word.
Well, let's go on with our interview with Craig Good. Well, we are being joined now by Craig Good. Craig, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi.
And Craig, tell everyone a little bit about yourself. You are in the film industry. We wanted to bring you in to help our conversation. We're going to have a follow-up conversation about film editing. Tell us about your background.
Well, I'm not a film editor, but I love editing. I worked at Pixar for over 30 years and described
Whoa.
It as
awesome.
Being at the world's best film school, which it really was.
Pixar is awesome. Yeah, you hosted us, the SGA, when we were there a few years ago. It was awesome.
That was awesome.
It was a great time.
Epic trip.
This is what happened. We had an off-the-cuff conversation last week about the pace and the style of editing film. And we made a few basic points, which I stand by, but it sparked a lot of interest among our listeners. We got a lot of email about it, so I thought we would go back and do a more detailed discussion about it. The basic premise is that the pace of movies generally has been increasing over the decades, that this is partly due to the style, the art, and the technology of film editing, and that modern sensibilities about what the pace of a movie should be affects our perception of movies in general. So what was your reaction to our discussion last week? I know you listened to it.
Yeah, I was largely in agreement. I think there are some subtleties and reasons as to why movies seem to move along faster now than they used to. But yeah, anybody watching an older movie can tell that the style of editing and movie pacing has changed over the years.
But it's not just the movies themselves. We made a comment. I watched E.T. Like 12 years ago, and I was aghast at how slow and boring it was, a feeling that I did not have in 81 when it came out. I mean, the movie was a phenomenon. But so not only has the movie editing changed, but my appreciation of the editing has also changed in that time as well.
Audiences have changed a lot. They've gotten a lot more visually sophisticated. E.T. first came out before home video was really a common thing. And it was really fairly recently when movie makers had to start dealing with the fact that people could see their movies over and over again. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you'd go to the theater and see it once, maybe a handful of times if you were a huge fan, and you couldn't freeze frame or any of that stuff. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah. From what I found reading deeper into this in the last week, it sounds like there's at least two things going on, and I think it's controversial whether or not they're separate or related. But one is the average shot length. And I've found studies that indicate that the average shot length, you know, the length of the, you know, one shot, not a scene, but one small mm-hmm. shot, has decreased from steadily in a pretty linear fashion from 1930 until today. The average shot length in 1930, what do you think it was? What do you guys guess?
Oof, it's probably long.
Shot length?
Four hours.
Two and a half minutes.
12 seconds. Yeah. So the average shot length in 1930 was 12 seconds. What do you think
it
is today?
Doesn't seem right.
3 seconds. Today I'm
going to go with about five.
a nanosecond.
2.5.
What?
From 12 seconds to 2.5 seconds. So that is objectively an increase in the pace of movies, right? I mean, I think that's pretty objective. But what's interesting is how linear that's been since 1930. So it's not a recent phenomenon. It's not caused by, some argue, any change in the style of editing. It's sort of been an independent phenomenon that's been chugging along since pretty much the beginning of movie making. Yeah, that's very interesting.
So digital editing, you didn't see a bump when digital editing was introduced?
There's no bump. I mean, maybe all of these things contribute, but they were contribute to continuing this trend.
Right.
There was no discontinuity. We're like, oh, that's when this happened, you know?
It's like going from magnetic core computer technology, you know, to a vacuum tube, you know, to solid state. It's like it's a different paradigm, but it doesn't matter.
But Moore's law is consistent regardless of the underlying technological progression.
It's a straight line from here to max headroom.
Yes.
And the other sort of big concept that keep coming up in my reading was the transition from classical to post-classical editing.
There was a style of editing that really got started in the really early days of cinema, you know, Sergei Eisenstein and people like that who figured out montage. Yeah, the real basic thing there is that images or scenes change depending on their context. So it's a lot about juxtaposition. The famous example is a shot of a woman looking at something. If the shot before that was a baby, then we read her scene one way. If the shot before that was a dead body, we see that same shot in an entirely different way.
Sure. That makes sense.
They talk about the seamless edit. So in the classical style, the goal is for the edits to be invisible, right? Invisible edits, meaning that there's this absolute continuity from one shot to the next so that you don't even realize where you're not reminded of the fact that you're watching a film. It's all supposed to be as seamless and invisible as possible in order to maximize a coherent narrative. That's the classical style. The post-classical style, which is also called the MTV style, I don't know if they still use, if the actual film users use that term, filmmakers, but that they, in what I was reading about, they all call it, sometimes called the MTV style, is like a music video where it's all jump cuts. You're constantly reminded that you're watching a film because it's edited in such a way to emphasize mood and character, but not plot, you know, not this story. And the story becomes almost incoherent, or non-linear, or there's multiple layers of a story being told at once and you're sort of jumping among them in a disjointed way.
Is what you're saying the distinction between, what they're calling continuity editing, which is more structural, getting you from point A to point B, or the other type, which is, I think they call it the Soviet montage, which is more to kind of evoke an emotional response.
Yes, that's exactly correct. Yeah, it's exactly correct. So
yeah, it's all about the emotion.
But apparently, obviously, this is a false dichotomy because there are movies do both, you know, or it's a spectrum, you know. But what it seems like is that even though, like, in 1930s, there were people who were using post-classical editing type of gimmicks, there's definitely been an evolution more towards, you know, away from the classical and towards the post-classical editing, which also creates a faster, more frenetic kind of pace to the experience of watching the film. Cause you don't have these, cause you know, in the real, like 1940s kind of classical editing, you would see somebody, if they were going from one room to the next, you would see them open the door, exit the room, close the door, walk across the hall, open the door, walk into the next room and close the door, right? You would, that whole exchange would be on film. Now, you just jump to them in the next room and the editing and the directing has to communicate the transition in other ways. You know, you're not explicitly watching them walking from one room to the next. And that's what I experienced, like when I've been watching a lot of older movies with my daughters, and in those scenes when there's this really long continuity, they are instantly bored with that. They just, they don't have the attention span. They're like, what is taking so long? I mean, just boom, just be there, you know? They just
call filler.
I think less than attention span, it's that sophistication that people have absorbed film grammar. There's a grammar in the way this talks. And so you can just be more efficient that way now. People will go with you on cuts. They've been taken there step by step as this has progressed. As you noticed, as you mentioned, it's been kind of a linear decline in shot length.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's sometimes we kind of young people get a bad rap because we think of it as like, oh, they're all ADHD now and that's why they can't. And it's like, no, it's just like they, right? Your daughter's much younger than I am,
yeah.
are more efficiently viewing film.
Mm-hmm.
There's just an efficiency to the kind of the neurological process where it's like, why am I watching this? This is not relevant. We could be getting more content here.
Yeah, you're more literate. Another big reason I think that things have gotten faster is that screens got small. When you're cutting a film, that continuity of editing, the classic thing, used to be something called the Lubitsch touch, Ernst Lubitsch. People noticed that when they watched his movies, they just seemed to flow better than other movies, and they weren't sure why. A big part of what he was doing was what editors call iFix, or at Pixar we called it hookups, which is a good filmmaker will use all kinds of techniques to guide your eye around the frame. You know, we know where you're looking, not just when, but we know which part of the frame. And if you make the important element of the next cut appear in that same part of the frame, your eye is just there and catches it.
I see.
Cool.
That was my job for over 20 years at Pixar, was just tweaking the camera to make those kind of hookups work.
Oh,
and
sweet.
If you have a giant screen, you know, if you're looking at an 80-foot wide screen and you suddenly require the audience to reacquire a target at a random place, that can take a half second or more. And that's an eternity in animation or filmmaking. So films that, you know, every Pixar feature you watch has been guided to do this by Lee Unkrich, an editor and director there. He directed Toy Story 3, but he started on Toy Story as an editor. He really has pounded that into us. And so your eye gets guided around the frame, and whatever you're supposed to see next is right where we left your eye off. Now, on a small TV screen, you can get away with murder.
Yeah.
The whole screen is inside a little tiny area of your vision. So that's why music videos could just slam whatever they felt like together. They didn't have to worry about eye hookups and things. If you go to an IMAX film, you'll notice it's cut even now at a much slower pace because there's a giant screen and it takes longer for you to take it in.
Mm-hmm. That's my feeling.
So, Craig, is it fair to say then for so many years at Pixar, your main job was pretty much to get hookups? Is that what it was?
Yeah, pretty much.
I was waiting for that one.
And I failed at it, apparently. That's why I'm not there anymore. I don't know.
So here's another angle to the discussion that came up that I found interesting. A lot of our listeners seem to think that we were saying that modern movies are better than older movies. I don't know that we were really saying that, but that is an interesting question. And that is, do you think that movies are objectively getting better in that the art of editing, for example, is getting more sophisticated and audiences are getting more sophisticated? And can you even say, this is sort of a deeper question, you know, when you're talking about anything artistic, is it too subjective to say that, you know, anything is objectively better?
Yeah, better is really hard to measure. I always say you can't compare things you can't measure, right? It all becomes opinion at that point. But yes, I don't know that films are getting better. The craft of filmmaking, I think you could arguably say, is getting better because people have had more practice and experience with it. And of course, you get better at things you do a lot. And everyone's building on the experience of filmmakers that went before. And that's probably part of why you can communicate more information in a film in a shorter amount of time now than you used to. I don't think that makes the overall film better. I like to say that the only reason movies exist is to convey emotions. Right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that's all they do. If you happen to learn something useful about how to ride a horse or rob a bank, that's fine. But it's really emotions. And the technical term for a movie that fails to engage you emotionally is boring.
Yeah.
That's the one thing, you know, the commandment in Hollywood is thou shalt not be boring. So emotion really is the number one priority in how movies are shot, acted, written, edited, everything. People are getting better at getting that music.
Mm-hmm.
I say music because movies are really more like music than they are like painting because it's a temporal art form.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. As the artist, you're deciding not just what people are seeing, but for how long. There's a great Tom Waits quote. He said, I always thought that songs are movies for the ears, and at its best, a film can be like a song for the eyes.
And when you combine the two, it's incredibly powerful.
Oh, God.
Oh, when you get it all working, yes, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. It is interesting to me how powerful a compelling image and a compelling music that both conveying or playing off of each other to magnify the emotion of a scene. It's incredible how powerful that could be.
It's stupendously powerful. And a good editor, I say that editing is where movies are made. Everyone else's job is to get them the raw materials.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
it's true.
It's really, if you've never done editing, you have no idea how incredibly powerful it is. Star Wars tangent. A long time ago, I got to sit down at a prototype of the edit droid, which is what went on eventually to become Avid. That's the prototype.
Wow.
Avid, yeah.
Yeah.
And they had a little demo system set up with some footage from Return of the Jedi. It was all running off Laserdisc and stuff. It was pretty kludgy by today's standards. But, you know, I could sit there and do nonlinear editing, which was mind-expanding anyway. But they had the scene where Luke and Yoda are talking to each other. They're on Dagobah.
Mm-hmm.
And I made one little change. I played with it where Yoda says, you know, when, you know, look I so old to young eyes? Instead of staying on Yoda, I cut to Mark Hamill's reaction on that. And the little smile he made said, not only do I find you really old looking, but it made the scene suddenly play as a comedy.
Mm. Yeah.
Huh. It was like light bulbs going off over my head. Holy cow, a little tiny choice. You know, who are we looking at this moment and what are we seeing them do? Just completely changes the scene.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of, we've all seen those trailers. They take like this, a movie, like a horror movie. They redo the trailer and then now it's a comedy and it's a damn horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Maybe we can't say that movies are getting objectively better, but we could say that the editing is getting more efficient. And people are expecting that efficiency. And if they're watching a movie that is inefficient in communicating information, they can get frustrated or bored with that. Do you think that that's legitimate?
That's probably pretty close. Yeah, the craft is getting better. Both the filmmakers and the film watchers are converging on a higher, more efficient level of how to tell stories. Mm-hmm. I still think that there are old movies that are every bit as good, if not better, than anything going on today. That, you know, the 90% of everything is crap rule has applied all through movie history.
Sure, sure, yeah. And yeah, a lot of people, you know, I've had that experience too, having this conversation. People go, well, what about Citizen Kane? What about Casablanca? It's like, yeah, those are brilliant movies that stand outside of time almost. They're timeless. So, you know, we're talking about general trends in film. We're talking about the average film, not the standout, right, brilliant artistic genius, right? You think that's fair?
Sure.
Yeah, Steve, I understand what you're saying. That makes sense. But when I think about it, though, I mean, say you've got a brilliant film from the 50s, yet it's still brilliant according to modern sensibilities, even though they may have been very inefficient, or were they kind of ahead of their time? How do you explain it?
Well, I think partly it's ahead of their time. I think brilliant directors, editors, whatever, are ahead of their time. But I also think that when we're watching a film from the 50s, we're evaluating it as a film from the 50s. If this was released today, I don't think we would have the same reaction.
That is the argument I always have with you guys and your emotional connection to the early Star Wars trilogy. Not that it's not amazing, but it's one thing. Everybody shits on Attack of the Clones, and I get it. I get that, like, the prequels people have a hard time with the new Star Wars movies, but the truth of the matter is, it's a good movie. Like, the things that went into making that movie are technically more impressive than many of the things that went into making.
Oh, technically the movies were
early
great.
Early Star Wars, yeah.
Got a generation better.
The characters
think of it in terms of music.
Horrible, but.
Think of it again in terms of music. If you go back and take some really old music, you know, well, not that old, Mozart, Beethoven, you know, go back to the classics. The greats still move you emotionally completely. Mm-hmm. You know, you bring it up to date, and there's modern jazz that might clip along at a much higher pace. They might get a lot more technical sophistication into it. The good stuff will still move you, but it's just a different style.
Yeah.
So I think the good movies are good because they still engage you emotionally. They still say something about what it is to be a human trying to get by in this world.
Right.
And that will wrap you up no matter how old the film is.
That is such a good comparison for anybody who's ever studied music, because you can master Mozart oftentimes. I mean, as a vocalist, we did when I was so young, because it's all 4-4, common time, key of C. It's actually not that complicated, but it's incomparable, I think, to other musicians in terms of the emotion that it evokes.
Yeah, still so moving, right?
Interestingly, over the weekend, I saw the movie The Revenant. Anyone else here see that movie?
No, but I have tickets.
I need
to see it soon.
So this was, by modern standards, an incredibly slow-paced movie, but every moment was absolutely gripping. It was an awesome movie. So that is interesting to me in light of this conversation. You could still have a modern movie. I mean, you know, yeah, I'll notice that, like, you do start with some action, and, you know, I think that the director and the editor of that movie did a masterful job of managing a modern audience through a movie that has long scenes where not much happens, you know.
You could argue that takes even more skill.
It does.
Well, it's the suspense that grips.
Well, it was just, it wasn't just suspense, you know.
It was. Every scene seemed to have a life or death element to it.
Yeah, I think, but it wasn't just suspense. I think that it was, there was an emotion in every scene that gripped you.
That's it. As long as they have you emotionally.
Yeah, they did. They kept you emotionally even when, you know, there was just, all right, now they're walking through the snow
we're talking single shots that are minutes at a time.
Yeah,
the camera work was phenomenal.
Oh, the cinematography was amazing.
Did you see Birdman?
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Same director, I think.
Same director.
Yeah, he knows how to make a long shot.
The Revenant was only shot with natural light.
Whoa.
Did you know that?
Yeah, I believe.
Is that even done anymore? So, what the hell?
Yeah, so it was like an hour and a half of filming every day. That's it.
Oh, shit.
Well, it, you know,
they didn't want any artificial lighting.
Right. A story that existed before electricity. So,
but it is very hard to shoot a film without lighting it.
That's the Black Stallion all over again.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm.
What about the Black Stallion?
Oh, Carol Ballard had a 1,000-to-1 shooting ratio on that film.
Ooh. Oh, my God.
That's why every single shot is gorgeous eye candy. You know, all shot at magic hour because you don't get many hours a day to shoot when you do that. And he shoots all kinds of stuff, just shoots and shoots and shoots so that he's got stuff to choose from and he can put together. Because you can be emotionally swept up by sheer beauty. You don't need to have stuff happening in the frame necessarily. And it sounds like what they might have done in Revenant.
Hey, Craig, I was wondering, do you have the one movie, if we're talking about editing, and your favorite edited movie? Can you pare it down to one movie that is a must-see?
Believe it or not, I think I can. Because if you phrase it that way, you know, pick one favorite movie, I don't know. But every time I learn something new about filmmaking and then go back and watch Lawrence of Arabia again,
I
realize that he knew that too.
Yeah. Whoa.
That movie is a masterpiece in just about every respect. Probably the best screenplay ever written. The cinematography, you could take – I mean, it's nearly 4 hours of film. You could take any frame out of that movie, blow it up, hang it on your wall, and you'd be happy. I mean, you know, it's not perfect. There, you know, you can find the tire tracks in the desert. You can – if you look for them, you can find the TV antennas in Cairo, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the filmmaking, the cinema of it, and the storytelling is, I think, on a level all its own. I just didn't know that.
Lawrence of Arabia, great movie.
I do have a book recommendation for any listeners who are fascinated by the idea of motion picture editing. There's a great little book and very easy read by Walter Murch called In the Blink of an Eye. Grab a copy of that and look at it. The short takeaway is that he points out that our lives are edited because you get a new shot every time you blink.
Well, Craig, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a fascinating discussion.
It's been awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, that I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You know, for this week, I saw the new planet one. I'm like, oh God, that would be perfect. And it was very recent. I'm like, oh God, I wonder if they're just too busy to have seen this.
A couple hours ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I figured, you know, just this has got to be too out there.
Yeah, more people
perfect,
said.
How perfect. If you imagine if you hadn't seen that news item, it would have gotten all of you on that one. I don't know, maybe.
10 times the size of the Earth.
Well, you could have totally faked us out. Yeah, you could have like compared it to like Uranus instead of Neptune or done something where we would not have caught it.
That's cheesy,
we're not up
though.
To speed. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, here we go. Three items. Item number one, neuroscientists have discovered that the amount of information the human brain is capable of storing is 10 times greater than previous estimates. Item number two, in the largest study published to date, researchers confirm an increased prevalence of depressive symptoms in the late winter and early spring compared to other times of year. And item number three, scientists have developed a new 3D microprinting technique that can create complex shapes, even overhanging shapes, with 3D pixels of only 800 nanometers.
Say what?
Evan, go first.
Okay. The amount of information the human brain is capable of storing 10 times greater than previous estimates. Well, lends credence to the whole use 10% of your brain kind of thing, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. No.
No.
Does that mean then we use our whole brains?
I wonder if does the physical space of the brain have to do with the storage capability? Probably. Therefore, they would have had to have come up with a way to find out that the brain is what? Has 10 times more surface area? Well, I don't think that's going to be the case, but something else might be going on there. I don't know about that one. I'll come back. And the next one is researchers are confirming an increased prevalence in depressive symptoms in the late winter and early spring compared to other times of the year. As well, the opposite to that is that no, they haven't found that, and this is kind of a either or sort of choice for science or fiction. So I think there's a 50% chance that that one is going to turn out to be the fiction. The last one, scientists have developed a new 3D micro printing technique that can create complex shapes, even overhanging shapes, okay, with 3D pixels of only 800 nanometers. Okay, yes, small, very small. Developing a new technique, sure. Yeah, they must have been able to do that. I mean, they can make things that are so small. I'm going back to number one here. Brain is capable of storing 10 times greater than previous estimate. That, what's that, an order of magnitude, Bob?
By definition.
I don't think that's the case. That's a huge leap. 10 times. And really, what's the mechanism? What exactly would they have found out that, oh, well, we didn't look at this before. All of a sudden, here's 10 times more information. So I think that one's overstating it. Fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, an order of magnitude is gargantuan, but I just keep thinking, you know, there's so much about the brain that we don't know. There could be some subtlety with the dendrites in the axons. I'm not sure. I don't know. Something about it. It's possible. Let's see. Largest study. Let's see. An increased prevalence of depression late winter and early spring. I mean, that's on its surface. That sounds great. Like that sounds obvious. Like, yeah, that's too obvious. But yeah, I think about it. And why would depression necessarily, you know, increase at that time? Doesn't quite sound right. And the micro printing, that sounds fantastic. Yeah, it's just a matter of time, I think, before they were able to have to print objects with that small of an element, 800 nanometers. I guess that's the tiniest little dot. It's 800 nanometers. Yeah, that's sure. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. Yeah, the one that's jumping out at me is this depression. There's something slick about that that doesn't sound right, especially like I said about depression. So I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Neuroscientists have discovered that the amount of information the human brain is capable of storing is 10 times greater than previous estimates. I would not be surprised if this were fact. I'm kind of annoyed with myself that I haven't read the article that you are probably referencing here, or the study. But I think that we've had some paradigm shifts in terms of the understanding of human storage capacity in the past. Researchers confirm an increased prevalence of depressive symptoms in the late winter and early spring compared to other times of the year. Well, seasonal affective disorder is a thing. I know this.
Yeah, that's
they call
I
it SAD. Yeah. And it is increased in the wintertime when it's dark. I don't know if it would be in late winter and early spring, because that's when the days actually start to get longer. But like suicide, sometimes it actually happens when the fog is lifted. I don't know if it's the same kind of thing with depressive symptoms of seasonal affective disorder. But this one's sticking in my craw a little, because I'm thinking that it's actually early winter, like late fall, early winter is more likely. We'll get back to that. And then scientists have developed a new 3D microprinting technique that can create complex shapes, even overhanging shapes. That's cool. Overhanging.
Yeah, so that's cool.
Figure out how to make them stick together really well with 3D pixels. I don't even know what a 3D pixel is. I thought pixels were light. I didn't know they were like actual material. So 800 nanometers.
Just a euphemism, for the smallest possible element.
So, yeah.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. And so nanometers are, 800 nanometers is actually not, I mean, it's small, but like I think a hydrogen atom is like less than one nanometer. And I saw an awesome movie once that IBM produced where they actually manipulated hydrogen atoms and made a little outline of a boy, and he jumped on a trampoline and stuff. So I know we can do crazy stuff with very small things, even things that are much smaller than this. So I actually think this seems reasonable. So I guess the one that's bugging me is the seasonal affective disorder one. Maybe that's a fiction. I don't know.
Okay, so I guess I'll take this in reverse order, since you all agree with the third one. Scientists have developed a new 3D microprinting technique that can create complex shapes, even overhanging shapes, with 3D pixels of only 800 nanometers. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
This one is baby. Very cool. Mm.
It's very cool.
The printer uses a form of copper. So the final result, the little things that they're printing, are essentially made out of copper. So they're metal, and they're rigid, and they can actually function as little machines, which is cool.
Oh man, sweet, it's coming.
Wow. Yeah. Bob, one of your many futuristic dreams is coming to reality in your lifetime.
And yeah, they stick together so well that they could make overhanging pieces. So in other words, it doesn't. You could make things stick out to the side. Yeah, it doesn't have to be
straight up and down
or something else.
Yeah.
So you could, they've showed like spiral shapes, for example, or shapes where, again, where there's something that is jutting out to one side and it all works fine.
Ah.
And the resolution looks, they look really well manufactured for these tiny, tiny objects. I mean, their shapes are pretty smooth and regular. All right, let's go on to number two. In the largest study published to date, researchers confirm an increased prevalence of depressive symptoms in the late winter and early spring compared to other times of year.
Oh.
Bob and Kara thinks this one is the think this one is the fiction. Evan, you think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, so this was actually a little bit of a surprise. This was the largest scale or a very large scale survey of U.S. adults. Provides no evidence that depressive symptoms vary from season to season. It was
no way.
Yeah, to really.
So that debunks like kind of known diagnostics.
Yeah, it does.
Wow.
Wasn't this past Monday the most the day of depression or something? January 18th, they had it pinpointed to a day. I've heard
that
said
right?
before. Crazy, you know. I never believed it, but
I always just assumed it was the day with the least amount of daylight.
That would
but
be
December
21st. December 21st.
Yeah.
At least in this hemisphere.
They examined data from over 34,000 participants ranging from 18 to 99. And there was just no pattern. Flat across all four
seasons. Damn, how was the sample size?
It calls into question the existence of seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah, and it calls into question all of these like light therapy treatments that used to feel legitimate.
Yeah, gone.
They could be pseudoscience. Oh.
So
shit.
At least this means it's, we can't assume this is true anymore. We have to at least do more study and try to resolve this conflict now because we have this large survey which is in direct contradiction to what previous studies have shown. All right. All of that means that neuroscientists have discovered that the amount of information the human brain is capable of storing is 10 times greater than previous estimates is science.
Love that.
That's awesome.
This is a cool story. So let me explain to you. This is, again, it's very, a little wonky neurologically, but I think I got what they're talking about here. What they were looking at was the sizes of dendrites and axons. So this is the sizes of the connections between one neuron to another. And they said that that's one of the mechanisms by which our brains store information. You know, each connection is like a piece of information. But not only that, the strength of the connection is information. And the strength of that connection is largely stored in the size of the axon and the dendrite. And those sizes match, right? So like when an axon connects to a dendrite, they become the same size. And that locks in that bit of information for that memory, right? Now, previously, we were able to detect that the sizes of the axons and dendrites basically came in three different sizes. They were small, medium, or large.
Oh, wait. Slow down there. Okay.
Right? So,
but those are like arbitrary distinctions, right?
But no, but they said that's it. They come in three sizes. Whatever, what you call them is arbitrary, but that they said that was basically it. And
so all the smalls were the exact same. All the mediums were the exact same. That is so weird.
Yeah.
What?
and that therefore you could calculate the amount of information that the brain can store theoretically if you assume that you have, you know, the system of information has these three different states, you know. What they found is that they actually could take 20, they could become one of 26 different sizes, and that this corresponds, you know, in information terms to about 4.7 bits of information. So if you calculate that out, that gives us an upper limit estimate of the total data storing capacity of the brain that's 10 times greater than what we previously thought. So it's because there are more different sizes that we could confirm and detect of axons and dendrites, that's the extra information.
And that amounts to a petabyte, which is what the internet contains.
Yes.
Damn.
That's so crazy. Also, I still have like – I feel like I have this sneaking suspicion that 26 is just as arbitrarily discrete as 3.
Yeah.
And that there will be more.
Yeah.
That right. This is just what we know of now.
So I'm wrong today, but I'll be right at another time.
Well, it's possible, Kara. The one thing that's interesting to note is that the brain is an analog computer. And
that's
so
true.
It's not really a digital computer. And so that this is sort of an analog system here. And not only that, but it's not just the size of the neurons, that the neurons, the axons and dendrites, when they fire, they don't always transfer the signal. Mm-hmm. The signal only gets transferred some of the time.
20%.
So now we have different permutations on top of this.
That's part of the information storage also. And that's what the sizes affects. The size affects how frequently that signal gets across. So it's a very complicated way that the brain is storing information.
Yeah. And Sounds like a kludge.
Yeah. You can't really make this direct analogy to digital computers because it really isn't. It's first of all, it's not hardware or software. It's wetware and it's really analog and it's massively parallel. Computer's not really a great analogy for it, but still information is information and we can try to calculate theoretically like how much information it could store. And I don't think we've reached the theoretical limit either, but it's interesting that just this one discovery says, yeah, that means it could store 10 times more than what we were saying.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Also, how great is that word wetware?
Yeah.
What a descriptive and beautiful word what we're saying.
Electrochemical wear.
Evan, before the quote, quick announcement. Registration for Nexus has opened.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
Nexus now. Is the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. It is co-hosted by the New England Skeptical Society and the New York City Skeptics. It is, you know, obviously the SGU will be there. Kara will be there with us this year. We're going to be doing our SGU extravaganza hosted by George Schwab. And guess who we have lined up for speakers this year? Check this out. We have 3 big names this year. We have a great full lineup of speakers, but 3 real big names. Richard Dawkins.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh.
Bill Nye is coming back.
Bill Nye! Yeah.
And Richard Wiseman.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Yeah, so this is going to be our best year, I think.
Two dicks and a bill.
Yeah.
I'm so embarrassed that made me laugh really hard. Yeah.
But in addition to all the SGU goodness, there's going to be the Cy Babe will be joining us. Climate scientist Michael Mann, the hockey stick climate scientist, the famous guy.
Yep.
Carol Tavris, Julia Galef. And we'll have a full day of science-based medicine with the usual crowd plus some extras. It's going to be awesome. So really great workshops. I'm doing 3 workshops this year, which is fine. I love doing workshops.
Wow.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah. A lot of shopping around. So go to necss.org and register today. It's going to be a great conference. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
I read this recently in an article. Fat isn't bad. Stupid is bad. And until we have better information and clearer shared language defining our food, smart choices will be ever harder to make. And that was written by a gentleman named Michael Ruhlman, who's an author, Epicurean. He has a great interest in the restaurant business and chefs and catering and all these things. And he wrote an article earlier this week, which appeared in the Washington Post, titled, "No Food is Healthy, Not Even Kale."
Kale?
I love that.
And the basis of the article is that the word healthy is a bankrupt word, right? Our food isn't healthy. We are healthy. Our food is either nutritious or not nutritious, somewhere in between. So he's basically saying that these words, you know, words do have important meanings. It's important to use the correct words. We misuse the word healthy so much in our day-to-day vernacular that it cannot be applied to the food that we eat. And it's a good reminder.
I think he's spot on. You know, there are some people in my life, I won't say who they are, who are into this whole, oh, this food is good for you and this food is healthy and this food has this thing in it, which is really good for you. And it's like, yeah, you know what's good for you? Food. Food is good for you. It's good to eat food. Food is very nutritious. It's like there's nothing magical about any of these foods that you're talking about. These are just all nutrients. And yeah, those nutrients have functions. Of course they do. That's why they're nutrients. But it's just food. Get over it, you know? But they're obsessed with, oh, if I eat this blueberry, I'm going to get this one micronutrient, and this does this to the body. Therefore, if I eat more of them, I'm going to be magically healthier. It's like, no, it's not true.
Are you telling me that resveratrol won't let me live forever?
Oh, resveratrol.
Only in some cases.
Nor will antioxidants.
Oh, yes, the whole antioxidant.
Oh, God, what a load of bunk that turned out to be.
Well, it was from the beginning. All right, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Good show, everyone.
Cheers, Dave.
We miss you, Jay.
Great fun. And we miss you, Jay.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.